either have the eyes for the answer.
Okay, this is continuing the interview with Radhakrishnan. And, okay, now you mentioned that Jim Roberts was working at Caltech when you were first there on hydrogen external systems, did you say?
No, his interest was mostly...
Oh, no, I'm sorry, in the 1,000 megahertz fluxes.
Right. Well, he'd spent many years working on the sun. He's made all kinds of important contributions in many, many different fields. It surprised me a bit when you asked me about him. You didn't know much about him. The reason is perhaps less to do with you than with me, because I feel that if I was taught radio astronomy at all, it was by two people. One was John Bolton, the other was Jim Roberts, both of whom were at Caltech. And they were very, very different types. And it was a marvelous education in opposites, which I think is also the way education should be conducted. You shouldn't have someone who has an extremely balanced view of everything, that you should be subjected to different extreme views so that you can find your own sort of balance in between. And
well, what had Roberts worked on before?
The sun. He'd worked with Paul Wurld on the theory of solar bursts.
He's Australian, then.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, he is. He was one of the very early, among the earliest in the Australian group.
I see.
The Pawsey, Mills Christensen, Bolton Wild group.
Mm-hmm.
Jim was one of those. And Caltech was rather interesting at that time because staff was made up of John Bolton, who was an Englishman, Gordon Stanley was a New Zealander, Jim Roberts was Australian, Tom Matthews was Canadian.
It sounds like the cocktail lab now.
I was, and that was me, ex-Indian. And I think there was another nationality representative, but not a single American on the staff. On the other hand, all the students were Americans.
Yeah. The likes of Barry Clark and Kellerman.
Yeah. That's right. Bob Wilson, Barry Clark, Ken Kellerman, Al Moffat, Dick Reed.
Mm-hmm. So let me just ask about John Bolton. Can you just very briefly tell me where he went? I'm just confused. He both headed the Caltech and the CSIRO. Is that correct? He's been headed both places.
No, when you say CSIRO, it's...
The radio physics division.
No. Taffy Bowen was chief of the radio physics division, John Bolton. When he went back from Caltech, he went back as director of the Parkes Observatory.
I see, that's right.
Because the radio physics division then comprised of three sections. One was the Parkes Observatory, which John Bolton headed, and there was the Kolgoro Observatory, which is Paul Wild's machine, which he was the director. This is the 96-element heliograph. And then there was also a section doing rain physics or cloud physics, or had to do with seeding clouds and so on, which was a pet interest of Taffy's.
Okay, so that.
But John was literally started the Caltech Radio Astronomy Observatory and headed it till the time he left.
And where's Gordon Stanley now took over after?
Gordon Stanley became director after John Bolton left.
I see. And what's my other bit of confusion? John Bolton's still is in Australia now?
Oh, indeed, yes. Well, he was in Hamburg the day before yesterday.
I see. Okay.
But he is no longer director of the Parkes Observatory. He sort of... there was an interesting development in the sense that Paul Wild and John Bolton had parallel careers since way back when. It's rather interesting. I think they were born within a mile of each other. They both come from Yorkshire. They were both in the Navy during the war. They both ended up in Australia. They both got interested in radio astronomy. They both married Australian women, and they both had a spectacular career, each making, I mean, they had different fields. John was next to galactic radio astronomy, radio sources, and Paul was son. And their rise in the organization was almost literally parallel. And then they ended up each heading one of the observatories.
Right.
One of the
two sections.
Two observatories that radio physics had. And Taffy Bond retired early last year, and Paul Wild became chief of radio physics. And John Bolton, I think, was just absolutely tired of administration, one thing and another. He just wanted to be relieved of all the administrative responsibilities. So
he's back to science.
So he's back full time to science and extremely happy.
Probably, yeah. I think there are a lot of people that that haven't had the courage to do that.
Right.
It means less power.
Right, but you have to be very sure of yourself to do a thing like
that.
So that's the situation. So he's just a scientist at large.
Okay, well, back to Caltech. You worked with Bolton on hydrogen absorption.
Right, and that was just using the single dish.
Uh-huh.
And that's how, well, several things became clear to me that that was not the way to do hydrogen ion absorption and limitations and so on. And it was just about that time that the Caltech interferometer was being put together to do work in the continuum. And I got interested in saying if this thing could be made to work on the line. And that was the start of line interferometry anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Was it the first place that was ever done? Line interferometry?
Absolutely. And that was very, very interesting. Then we used, that was just one of many things that we did with the interferometer. When I got very interested in interferometry, anyone who's really played with interferometers somehow will never go back to playing with single dishes or thinks of it as something awfully
crude. Yeah.
You understand how single dishes work much better, and you understand how an interferometer works and so on.
And you also understand how they're wasting information.
Yeah, so that was just one of many many things done later. I got interested in the. In fact, the very first time that the interferometer was used on the line was not so much to look for absorption as to. I was interested in doing the Zeeman experiment far better than it had ever been done before. I figured that the interferometer was the best way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, but it hadn't been really verified before. It was just tentative reports out of Jodrell.
It was only Vizquero's observations a couple of years ago, I think, that really put it on a sure footing.
Right. So you got interested in.
But that's done on the 21 centimeter line, so we had to get the interferometer working on that. And then, of course, we discovered a lot of interesting things, and I discovered that was the way to do 21 centimeter absorption, the only way to make it really work.
Yeah.
So that led on to a vast amount of work, and Barry Clark and joined the original 21 centimeter line interferometer was put together by Paul Wilson, Dave Morris, and myself. Because we were interested in doing the Zeeman experiment. And then I found that the first time I tried it, I looked at 3C123, which was an order of magnitude weaker than, two orders of magnitude weaker than Cass. Or 50 times perhaps weaker than Cass. And lo and behold, there was a beautiful absorption profile, something that you couldn't have dreamed of doing with a single 90-foot dish.
Yeah.
So anyway, that started the.
Did you ever publish any Zeeman experiment stuff from Caltech?
There was a paper published by Morris, Wilson, and Clark. Three of them. Well, the work went on for quite some time.
On Zeeman effect?
Oh, indeed, yeah. there was a negative result.
Yeah.
See, it was the same time as Sandy Weinreb was doing it at Dream Bank. It was one of the things that his autocorrelator was built for, I believe. You know, he tried deuterium and then he tried the same other.
Where was that paper? In FJ?
FJ, mm-hmm. Yes. And another thing I got interested in trying to make the interferometer do is to measure polarization. And one of the first things that was done, coming back to Jim Roberts, was the detection of Jupiter's Van Allen belt.
And that interferometer,
yeah.
From the polarization structure.
Well, to show that Jupiter was polarized, 21 centimeters, and then to show that it came from a source that was bigger than the size of Jupiter by a factor of 3, and so on.
Mm-hmm. One other question, is this Bob Wilson the same one that's at Bell Labs
now? Indeed, yes.
Well, I think we'd better take a break here.
Okay, this is now 2 days later, 28th March, 72, continuing interviewing with Rad.
Well, now at Caltech, you worked on...
But before we get on to that, I should probably mention a couple of things. Just to help you out with the history of 21 centimeter absorption work, because I took a lot of trouble to go on it to find out what had been done. It sounds like advertising, but if you're interested in the history of with that particular subject, I mean, you did most of it by reading two papers. One of them was the Caltech, paper from Caltech by Clark, Radhakrishnan, and Wilson, 58 or so actually. And then papers 1 and 2 of this recent supplement, actually 2 or 3, January 1972.
Right.
I'm not talking about the physics of it now, I'm just talking about in the introduction, I've gone to some pains to try to straighten out. So what that was, what the previous picture was, what were the means and how we could change the pictures.
Certainly. Now you say you got involved with Jupiter at Caltech.
Yeah, well that was... this is actually a... long, very interesting subject. I'll try and condense it because there's an interesting history mixed up with this too. Jupiter, like most of the planets, was thought to just give off thermal radiation before there was any suspicion.
I have interviewed Kirk, but I've got his side of
it. Right. So you know the Jupiter has many personalities. Stuff that you got from Burke. It's all about the low frequency radiation.
Hello.
Well, I was saying there are very many sides to Jupiter, very many exciting sides to the story of Jupiter, and in fact, it has to do with all the planetary astronomy as well. But if you talk to Burke, you've got a whole story of the extraordinary low frequency. Then apart from that kind of stuff, which cut off at, I don't know, something like 15 eggs or something of that order, it was expected that Jupiter would just behave like a thermal source of high frequencies. And the very first measurement suggesting that something was wrong was made by Mayer and Koller Slovak. It was made using the Mesa, the Townsend company, looked at this 10 centimeters in order to access pressure. Among those people who immediately appreciated the significance of this material, and
Dr. Jim Roberts about it. Jim Roberts, after a whole series of observations with the one dish that was offered to I remember this whole business because, as I see, Jim and others people have told me, but it was funny, I can still remember asking them, what's flux density? Or what's flux unit? How do you measure it? All this sort of thing. And he did a lot of work. There was a book published by Gordon and Stanley, Stanley and Roberts, Roberts and Stanley, on this sort of thing. In this part of the story, you've got to be very careful on the long tape. You have to use your discretion. Great God Wind, some of this. Anyway, there was a paper published by Drake and Button. Button was an old year from the
year. So I went in a radio.
He's there to be around the year. He was one of the, he was the guy who built up the electronics facility at NRA, or he's the one who actually introduced the ideas that things should be built like that, with that kind of efficiency, where at this point you just put it up and run another receiver, where he said every item must be duplicated, both in the lab and the telescope, so everything can be tested, and so on. He's the guy who got Sandy Weiler to do this. Anyway, he, I think Drake got paid to come up into Washington, and they made some measurements. And Drake got to the waterfront, where Drake announced this to be flourish and the rest of it. Every country, he also claimed that it might follow different radiation curves, in terms of well. George B. Then, John Dalton, I think, suggested that, if the radiation, this was before the, I can't remember how it happened, anyway, there was a possibility that if there was an alternate radiation, it might be polarized. And so, as a result of that, there is an extremely well-known paper that was great in the middle, with a few fizz-red letters, again back in the 58, something like that, by Jim Roberts and himself, which show that the centigrade radiation in Jupiter is polarized. It can be a region three times the size of the planet. In other words, the whole story and essentially everything is established that the touch had an hour and both knows what radiation can.
In other words, you assumed a belt and you could derive the parameters.
How
did you know that it had to be a belt?
No, we didn't. No,
you said all of this was consistent with the data.
No. We detected that it was polarized.
Right.
And then Dave Morris was instantly there and he's doing all the observations. And then he was looking at this too. And we found it was polarized. And then we also noticed, because all these observations were made within the problem, there seemed to be some variation in the intensity, so there was the possibility that spalling dissolved as the RNA source changed. So of course when that number looked a little more RNA longer in the telescope, which is a visibility barrier in the source RNA. And we've got the picture
that
that was a very big turning point.
This was 58.
Not 58, this was 60. I was in there, out of work. It was one month out very long. done on Jupiter, but if you want to find stone given, so this is what you do. Next, for reasons that we can't go into here, John Dalton didn't want to go on Jupiter. That's really big. Dave Morris continued to work in Jupiter. And he published a paper. We were talking about papers with glass, of this quality. You should read a paper by Morris and Bird, which contained four, what I would call, four discoveries, any one of which would have made an interpretation. They worked on this. First of all, he showed.
This was now where in that day?
Oh, yes.
Around 62?
Yeah. Very important. So, he showed the polarization varied periodically. And that this was due, in other words, to the tilt of the magnetic field of Jupiter with respect to the rotational axis. He showed that he identified, I think, which was north and which was south. Pointing out the house that we have on the last show. He showed that the magnetic pole was displaced by just the right arm to explain. As he tied this up with a low frequency radio sphere. So, anyway, you can get all the details of your interest. That's all. It was an absolutely magnificent piece of work. And then he sort of handed it over to... This happened very often in Calgary, because there were a few of us who were on the staff and a number of graduate students in Austin and all the way to Rome. And they always got associated with sort of projects, and it ended up being their thesis, so you have to hand this one over. So Glenn Berg carried on his work and finally did some synthesis and produced an art. Same thing happened to the H-line stuff that I put an awesome amount of time into studying all of this, but then I joined in to get this thesis, so it was handed over. He did an awesome amount of work, almost from his own. And in fact, he was the one that, although the ideas that were floating on the lab for a long time, the hydrogen that we were seeing in the absorption, not the hydrogen that one sees in emission. It was Barry Clark who first proposed in his thesis and in the paper to write it his thesis. It might be necessary to hypothesize the existence of high temperature medium in which the clouds are embedded, which is at such a high temperature that it will lower
he was really the first person to propose that.
Oh, yes. It should be called glass hypothesis. But the ideas really have been kicking around before. And I think John Bolton had this. As I said, he mentioned this to me once in very early stage. And I really had to raise and stuff in a hot pudding. And we talked about it a bit in the paper that was the plaque of glass. Brother Christian Wilson paper, he would only find one sentence saying that one is led to wonder whether in fact it's the same hydrogen that.
Yeah.
So it's a history. Certainly that's the way it went. Then, well, that was Jupiter. So I think there's anything more to do with cancel or go after people saying the equation. Same sort of thing that's been happening to me Showing that it was in fact the method to do so. I've become terribly interested in performances, and I still am, as you call it. It's almost a more fundamental way of looking at things than if you want to understand the language you work with, and understand this different part of the people itself. So I really go off on this music. Of trying to use the diplomacy to do things that I was trying to do. Also, trying to do something that is quite conventional and I was doing so at the time. Fully not going to exaggerate to say that we could bring this then and then again. See, Dave Morris, well, actually, Jim Roberts, sort of vaguely given polarization of radio sources, which is pretty polarization. Connie Mayer has the music polarization prepared, and we've always been doing so as we could. And we've got to put the phone on the wire, ask them to see sources of their music on radiation and their polarization. So, Jim Roberts and I started doing because they couldn't play primitive. I don't know how much detail you want to go.
Well, not stuff that's available in the papers, but the motives, you know, and things like this, the why you went into graphics.
Yeah, but you see, the whole technique, because I've spent many, many years trying to understand the technique for making polarization.
Correlation properties of radiation, which I won't go into.
Yeah.